My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Very, very grateful to be here. And I need my cell phone because that's where my notes are. Got a pretty interesting story, but first, I'd like to see if there's anybody here for their first World Conference. Just raise your hand. Wow. Thank you for making the effort to be here and plan where you're going to be for 2020. I can remember rolling into Toronto, figuring out, you know, I knew that if the most important thing was to make it to the next World Conference, and it kind of secured my sobriety. You know, I know we do this thing one day at a time, but these events are so important to my sobriety, and I never thought I'd be standing in front of a microphone talking to anybody at one of these things, but I'm very grateful for it. And also, I'd like to acknowledge all the volunteers who, you know, wearing the green shirts, who spend their time and efforts to make sure we know how to get to a meeting that we're supposed to chair, like this morning. About 5 months ago, I get a phone call from New York City, and I'm going, I don't know anybody in New York, and it's the World Services. And they said, your email's broke. We had to call you. And I was like, no, my email working just fine. You know, I gave them the correct email. They said, we were wondering if you'd be interested in, you know, participating in the World Conference. And I would be like, who, me? Let me ask my sponsor. And but I'm sure the answer will be yes. Friday night, Saturday night preferred, you know, at 8 o'clock. But if those if those positions are filled, I'll do anything. And never heard back. So yesterday I'm looking at the schedule, and Mike B., oh, turning it over. I'm from Virginia. Is there any other? I don't know. Well, I'll just go there just in case. So, to keep an honest program, is there anybody out there named Mike B. from Virginia that's supposed to be here today leading a topic on turning it over? Because yesterday at 3 o'clock, trust me, I was turning it over. So I took a couple notes, and then this morning as I pulled in front of the place where I found a really cool place to park, I ran into one of my very first sponsors back there, and it was, pretty interesting. About being able to just get the courage and the encouragement that you can find in these rooms anywhere. And turning it over, he's a part of that. There's a little story, a little ditty I got about him helping me in this one situation. But, ever since I've been in AA, ever since I crossed the threshold from full-blown alcoholism into sobriety, that very moment that I came in here, I never wanted to leave. I've, the concept or the thought that there was something better for me out there other than inside the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has never entered my head. The thought process was, if it ever did, if I ever allowed that entertainment of that thought to get that close, there was a quicker way to end the pain. And that is pretty much how my story, my drinking story ended and my sober story started. So I was on a run. I was a geographical cure kind of guy, alcoholism wide open. And military family I grew up in, joined the military, and started riding motorcycles. And by the time I was here, I was just broken. I had a vision of my life being wonderful, picket fence, wife, two kids, couple cars, playing golf. And alcoholism crushed those dreams and literally crushed my life. I remember being at a phone booth in Fairfax, Virginia, at a Fairfax Circle, and I called up my former wife, actually my wife at the time, and I said, he's laughing because I've had a few of them. So is he. sorry. So I'm at the phone booth. I call her up, and she goes, it's about time I heard from you. I said, my mom and dad have been out, and your daughter, Callie, I've been with her for 3 days. My parents are on vacation. I need a break. So I got to the house. She made me a sandwich, you know, and I'd been on a week run. And she just left me with my daughter, who was not quite 18 months yet. And beautiful, you know, but dad's a drunk. And so first thing I do after I eat is I go pass out, right? And I'm laying there in bed. And this all ties in with the topic of turning it over, because it's the first time that I can actively remember doing it. Was this little baby crawled up on my chest and fell asleep, and I'm passed out. And then all of a sudden I woke up, and long hair and goatees, and this baby's just like, and I look, wake up, and there's these beautiful blue eyes and this beautiful smile, and she goes, Dada. And she falls right back to sleep on my chest. And I started crying. And the brokenness of a human being that I was, it was an existence that could only be maintained by alcohol and drugs. And so when I had that experience for the first time, two things happened. The first time I prayed, and the first time I gave something 100% effort, like I've never wanted anything before in my life. I prayed to God to change my life, make me a different person, so I could show up for this little girl the way that I was supposed to. And that's when my journey started. I had a focus, and I started going to AA, and I had 30 days of sobriety. And I pulled up to see my daughter, but this time the in-laws were back. And Dad, who was a CIA, you know, operative kind of guy, was like, I never knew if I was going to make it, you know, because I figured, as big of a schlep as I was, I figured he'd cap me some way. And but I was walking to go get my 30-day chip, and he walked out to my car, and he said, I'm glad you're sober, but those are dead tags on the car. That's a dead inspection sticker. I bet you don't even have insurance. And I went, and he didn't pull any plugs and just ripped me. And I started crying, and I said, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you that I can change. And I already knew that I wanted to, but that was, you know, another. So I had two major motivators, you know, that were, that I was connected with family. And I just kept going to AA. And so I turned that over, and I said, God, you know, I'm trying to be a different person. I'm willing to do anything, but I have no practice. I have no experience. You know, I'm not a street gutter drunk, but, you know, I'm like, let me sleep on your couch till I get my stuff together kind of drunk. And by the way, do you have any money and food and beer and all that kind of stuff? And God and the program Alcoholics Anonymous, like they did for me, like they do for you, like they do for anybody, you know, who wants this thing, came into my life and just started changing. You know, I had the example of you people, you know, that said, you know, I don't have to drink today. I can actually make it and go to work, you know, come back, get a paycheck, and not go to the bar on Friday and be broke on Saturday. That was my routine. So I started doing that, and another experience I had in turning it over, within 2.5 to 3 months that I was sober, my work experience, like I was former military and I had some, you know, accomplishments. But I ended up being a construction laborer, carpenter helper. Yes. There's a seat over here, sir. There's a carpenter helper. And my routine was that they had houses that they poured concrete in. They had houses that were framed. They had houses that we put drywall in. And then they had houses that were finished. I would go to the houses that were finished and grab the big refrigerator boxes and take them over to the houses under construction and throw them up into the rafters and go up there and sleep till lunchtime. And it was quite an experience. And so within 3.5 months of being sober, I'm a foreman running a crew, and there's this pothead, right? He didn't drink like I drink, so I never liked him anyway. And he was kind of a hippie-ish kind of guy, and, you know, that wasn't me. And so we had the company that we worked for was going to inspect the property. And I was like, I had all my stuff squared away. You know, my buildings were, you know, clean. And the pickup truck that he was driving had a pack of rolling papers on the dashboard. And I was like, dude, you got to get rid of them. He goes, what the hell is wrong with you? And I was like, nothing. You know, we're just having these big guys come in. And he told me to basically piss off. And I was like, all of a sudden I remembered I was a Marine and a Green Beret and a biker. And, you know, and I'm like, this guy's going to die. I've never done anything like, you know, that, but it was like, all of a sudden this rage just came through me, and it was like, you know, the world's going to be a better place without this guy. It's somehow, you know, and I had treated my alcoholism with a lot of anger, and all of a sudden anger came in and just shifted the focus. So I'm ready to light this guy up in a million ways, and all I could do is pray for Friday, because that's when my sponsor and I would go to a meeting. We're driving to the meeting, and he's like listening to me, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, maybe I could blow that building up somehow and all this stuff. And he's like, over a pack of rolling papers. I was like, absolutely. And I can't think of a better reason than to take this guy out. And then all of a sudden, you know how they have this it was like an anomaly. He goes, have you tried turning it over? And I was like, huh? I'm like, why? It feels good to hate, you know? And I didn't know that it felt good to hate. I just did. And I was like, you know, I don't know how. He goes, ask God to take it away. I was like, God doesn't like me. And he goes, ask him anyway. And I was like, you're here. This is something we're supposed to do in private. And he goes, I'm your sponsor. Ask God to take it away if you really want. If not, stay pissed. So I asked God right then. And all of a sudden, you hear stories about it. You know, and if it hadn't happened to you, I don't expect you to believe it. But I got washed over with a feeling of peace for the first time in I can't even remember. And the thought that, you know, the world was okay, that I belonged here, that I'm in the right place, and I'm going in the right direction, was phenomenal. And I looked at him, and then all of a sudden, it changed again like that. And I was like, is there like a permanence to this kind of thing, you know? I'm looking, I do the work for like 5 seconds, I want lifelong results. He says, it's a practice. Keep practicing. Problems come up, keep practicing, you know. And that's what I've done. I keep practicing. And, you know, it's like I always think, you know, it's either there's a permanence or I'm going to cross the finish line or I'm going to have some sort of wonderful permanent outcome to where I can build on that and I can build on that. And the fact is, I do get to build on things, but I get to build on my failures as much as I get to build on my winnings. My higher power has never, ever, I've never gone without a meal. I've never gone without a place to live. I've never, you know, had experiences. I've had experiences that I've regretted. A lot of them in sobriety. That's my thought process. But in the long run, further down the road, those experiences are things that have allowed me to grow in ways that I couldn't see when I went through those experiences, and I wished I never had them. Kind of a double-edged sword, but that's what I found out. That's what winners do. You know, winners just suck it up, you know, point to 5 years down the road at the 2020 conference, you know, whatever I got to do to maintain my sobriety, one day at a time, 1 year at a time, 5 years at a time, or whatever. And to tell you the truth, I got this little goal in my head, you know, when AA turns 100. Where's it going to be? And where, you know, like, now all I got to do is live that long. You know what I mean? And we do it one day at a time. I'm not knocking any of that stuff. Hang on, let me get back to my notes here. There was, and like I said, I ran into my sponsor who's helped me so many times. He just celebrated 45 years of sobriety. And I had just come back from St. Croix. I had, somebody needed some construction work down there, and I was like, you know, okay, I'm going to go down and just do my thing and help these people. When I came back, he's like, you know, Mike, he goes, you bet like you're 8 or coming up on 8, 10 years, something like that. He goes, what's your next thing in sobriety? You know, it wasn't like, what do you want to go accomplish or whatever. It was like, in your sobriety, what's your next thing? Because we knew and we know, like today, that everything is around our sobriety. You know, that's where it starts. I was like, well, I want to learn time management and make money. And he goes, really? I was like, what do you mean? And he asked me like that 3 times. I'm like going, you got a hearing problem, man? Like, that's what I want in, you know, my sobriety. And he goes, well, what about relationships? I was like, what about them? And he said, relationships with a higher power, relationships with, you know, your fellow AAs, relationship with friends. I was like, I already got that. And he goes, well, what about improving it? I said, you know, that's on its own timeline. You know, I'm not really required to put a whole lot of effort there. And this is me with 8 or 10 years of sobriety, folks. I just want to let you know that. That's not my position today. And I had done a lot of work with my relationships with a higher power. And I had done a lot of work with my relationships with my fellow AAs. And I had done a lot of relationship work with my family and friends. And then I hit a point where everything was cool. And my turning it over ended up looking like, good job, Mike. You did really good. You know, you put that bank deal together. You know, you got out of construction and you got into real estate. And then you got into finance and you built this empire. Good job, you know, and look what you did. It ended up being, and this is in sobriety. I never stopped service work, and I never stopped praying, and I never stopped having a relationship with a higher power, but I became a person that was, I just didn't intend to be, you know, that person. It wasn't a bad person, but it wasn't the person that I really wanted to be. And so after a couple exchanges of, you know, I want to make money and time management, and he's like talking about relationships. He finally looks at me and he goes, how can you be so shallow? And I went, what? Talking to me? You know, I'm this guy. And how are we doing on time? 1 more minute. Okay. 1 minute to finish the story. That's what it took for me to realize that the person that I am, I can't do it alone. Even when I have all you people, even when I have AA, I need a higher power. And for me to turn it over, I need to turn it over to the entity that was there when my daughter crawled up on my chest. But I needed to develop a better relationship with my higher power. And it's through the practice and the experience that I've had in AA, always remembering, turn it over. Turn it over. God can handle it. God can take care of it. And working on improving my relationship with my higher power, that's where the answer is for me. And I appreciate the opportunity this morning to be with you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. That was very good. I was going to talk a little bit about my first experience in this, and it starts when I was out there drinking. I would wake up every morning remorseful with a hangover. I know we've all heard about the four horsemen, so they would be circling the bed, one, two, three, four of them, depending. And I'd start doing this prayer meditation, and what it was, I'd go take a shower, and I'd try to figure out excuses for my behavior for the last day and how I was going to get along. And I'd end up going to work with this idea, this not so solemn, but this oath to myself, I'm not drinking today. I can't afford it. I have too many things to do. I got all these other excuses why I can't, so I'm not going to drink today, and I would really mean it. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd start forgetting about that promise. I'd go out after work to have a couple drinks with a meal and then do some of the stuff that I didn't have done, and I'd close the bar down. I'd wake up the next day and do the same thing over and over and over every day. And every day I had the same methodology of fixing it. I'm not going to drink today, and every day I'd end up closing the bar down. So I never could figure out what that was all about. When it came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because my life for about the umpteenth time had become completely unmanageable. I'd lost everything. The last girlfriend walked out. She took everything we had in the house. And so I had some patio furniture in the living room. I did have one bed and a broken microwave. And there was various other things, but not very much in the house. And I was months behind on the mortgage, as you would know, and luckily to keep the utilities going. So things weren't going too well. And I barely had a job, but I had a job. So I wasn't that bad. And I had a car that if you took the carpet off the passenger side, you could watch the road go by. And I went to work with that. I didn't want to go out of town with it. I had to stay within town because it's not a big place where I live, but I wasn't sure I'd make it very far. And but I wasn't that bad off, but man, I didn't know what to do. And through a long term of events, I got involved in walking into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, not knowing what to expect. Scared. I thought I was had no fears, but I was scared to death for anybody to know I was going into AA. So I used to park in the bad part of town at night, blocked away from the AA building, so nobody would see me walking in. I didn't have any fears. Anyway, so I went into that room. The turning over point about this is that I had finally given up all hope of figuring everything out on my own. I'd been trying and trying and trying, and I knew I was doing the same thing all the time, and it wasn't changing. So it was more a matter of opening the door a little bit to accept the fact that maybe I don't have all the answers for change, and to try to listen to what other people had to say. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous rooms, and I heard you people talking your stories, and I related to them. And I saw people like Mike over here that had been around a while, and I wanted what they had. I heard their story, and I said, I want that. And I didn't know how to get it. But what I basically did, I just kept my ears open and went to AA meetings for a while. And that was my first attempt at turning it over. Eventually, that led to me sitting in the back of the room once after about 5 months of listening to these stories. You know, when I first walked in, I had to say my name. I'm Chuck, I'm an alcoholic, right? And I thought you had to do that. And I went to this meeting. I didn't think anybody would know me. I walked in the room, and I knew three people in the room. And the chairperson was calling people out by name when they went. I was going to say, I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. And I couldn't do that. So I had to say my name, and I almost choked. And so I went to a different meeting for the second time, and I kept going to there. Anyhow, so I was sitting in the back of the room. I made this mental connection that I related to you guys. I understood what alcoholism was, finally. It wasn't what I thought it was, and I am one. But I really wasn't convinced that I was an alcoholic. I knew it. I mentally knew I was. I was convinced that way, but I didn't feel it deep down inside. And I remember sitting in the back of the room, and we have steps painted on a board at the top of the room in my meeting hall. And I was looking at those, and I was staring at step one, and I think we were doing one of those God meetings, which I really wasn't liking. But I was looking at those steps, and all of a sudden I just knew I was an alcoholic. It was something changed, and I had to do this program. Well, anyhow, that's enough out of me for now. Our next speaker is Carolyn B. from Texas, and she says she has 27 years and has been involved in Intergroup too. So there's something here. We're all involved.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. My name's Carolyn. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since February 22nd of 1988, and I'm as grateful as I know how to be about that. And I suspect y'all can tell that I come from the South. I was born in Wimberley, Texas, you know, and Wimberley recently got national news when it was almost swept away by a flood. But see, if it had happened back in 1940, there'd only been about 60 of us there, and we were mostly relatives. So, yeah, it's hill country. You've heard about hill country. Well, we're not the ones over, you know, West Virginia, but we're the ones in Texas. And Texas, you know, around the South is known as the buckle of the Bible Belt. And so, you know, I was growed up. You know, out in the country, we didn't have water, electricity, any of that kind of stuff when I was a kid. And I kept being amazed when I kept seeing the stuff other people had. I'm like, God, what is that? Where'd that come from? So I've always kind of felt like I just didn't know I just didn't know. So, and I was the third of three children, and they were not pleased. I was a surprise. Because, you know, everything was kind of calm, and then here's this another baby. And I'm a Leo, born in the year of the dragon. So there's no way I can have a humble bone in my body. And also, I'm from Texas, and so I have a perfect right to have whatever I want. You know, whatever it is. So, you might imagine, my journey has been quite a struggle. A few of the cardinal things from growing up and from my past, that, you know, when I was, you know, like, we finally moved into town and I was going to grade school, and we had streets there. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, little gravel roads. It was streets. And my school was way down that way. And when I started walking home for lunch, I couldn't remember where the house was. Because I had never been where you had houses, like, right next to each other. We had places. And I'm walking up the middle of the street looking for my home. And my big sister comes out and says, "Hey, stupid, you're supposed to walk on the sidewalk." And, you know, I just always kind of felt like that. And I'll talk about my sister later on when we get to turning it over. You know, I did well in school. That was where I excelled. And I could get away from home, and I didn't have to listen to my mother, and I didn't have to be worried about getting all the chores done. And all that stuff, and I loved to read, because then I could go away from where I was. That was, you know, I just knew I was not in the right place. When I saw that movie, The Jerk, you know, this Steve Martin starts off in there. I was born a poor black child, and when I saw that, I thought, that's it. I was not in the right family. And so for me, I've had this feelings disease, as you can tell, for a very long time. And, you know, so I went on, you know, through school, got through high school. When I was turning 18, down where we live in Texas, it was in a dry county. So I found a guy that was old enough to buy booze, and got him to drive me over to the next town in his pickup truck. And I got me a half pint of bourbon. And I drank it. Because, see, I wanted to know what it's like to get drunk. Because I heard people talk about that all the time. And I drank, you know, a number of times and not really had anything. But when I took that little bottle of bourbon, A little while later, I was in somebody's yard with a hose in my face. See, and I thought that meant I got drunk. When y'all said, did you have a blackout? No. Because I didn't know what a blackout was. One more time, I don't know. But anyway, you know, I went on from high school, went to nursing school, and graduated, went into the Navy Nurse Corps, and that was back during the Vietnam conflict war, and went out to Oakland, California, to the Naval Hospital, and that was in September that I got out there, and then that November was when JFK was killed in Dallas. And so I felt bad for being a Texan there for a while because of, you know, such a blight on the net, on the world. But then on New Year's Eve, my friend had a party. And, you know, you walk into the room, there's that song, Late December back in 63. What a special night for me. There he was. And we started going out, got married 2 years later, and 9 months later had a little baby, and 4 months later he was killed in a plane crash. So in 13 months I was bride, mother, and widow. And I had, you know, when my parents had divorced when I was 12, I'd already told God, I made this vow to myself, you see, that I was never going to have to depend on a man because I didn't want to have to work like my mom did. When my dad went away, she, you know, started sewing seven days a week, and I didn't want to have to do that. So, you know, I was graduated from nursing school. And when the chaplain came, and, you know, and the other guys to tell me what had happened, and I had to call his mother and, you know, do those things, and I somehow just knew that God just really had it in for me. You know, my dad had gone away, and I was closer to him than I was to my mom. And my mom has told people that we come from a long line of mean women. And I can assure you she knows what she's talking about. So, anyway, but, you know, this so that now here I am. You took my dad and you took my husband. I must have done something really bad that you've done this to me. See, I'm special. And I said, that's it. That's all your chances. I'm going to make it in spite of you. And I went off to do that. I moved to Dallas, back into Texas, and got a job. And after about, you know, a year, my supervisor said to me, you know, if I was as young and smart as you, I'd go get a master's. I'm like, oh, okay. So I did that, you know. And then got a job, you know, switched from nursing in the hospital, in the intensive care unit, to teaching nursing school. And did that for a while, and I was doing that, and see, and I have, if you listen, there's this little pattern, you see, you go to school, and you go to therapy, and, you know, see, because we're going to get this all figured out and make it work. Well, I was in therapy, and then I got a call from this guy that had been my best friend's boyfriend, and his dad was on a Cotton Bowl commission, and he wanted to know, did I want to go to the Cotton Bowl? He broke up with my girlfriend, with my good friend. So I said, sure. That was the first date, New Year's Eve. Well, New Year's Eve, I went to his party at his house, and we were married income tax day. So we know this is real love. Destined for great happiness. He drank more than I did, you know. And I was a daily drinker, but I would stop a lot of the time. You know, I'd really only have two or three drinks. I had not crossed that line yet. And, you know, some of us are, I don't know that we're fortunate that way. Sometimes I think it would have been better to have a bad case early than to have a light case until late, but anyway, I've always had that alcoholic mentality that talks about in the book. I can always see how it's something about me and somebody did it to me. And I think that I deserve something back. Mm. And I don't know if any of you ever have had any of those experiences, but, you know, it's an awful place to be. I heard this one kid say one time, "My mind's like a bad neighborhood. I shouldn't go there unescorted." It's like, yeah, you know, that's me. So there, I'm not talking to God. I went back to school, and I got remarried, and I had a baby, and we were divorced 4 years later. Well, total of 8 years that we were married. And it was an awful, awful time, the last couple of years of that. His drinking had accelerated, and my drinking had accelerated. And, you know, what precipitated the divorce was he was having a temper fit, like I told him I was going to leave if he did anymore. And when I started to leave, he got my attention. And I said, that's it. I'll not have, you know, this. So, and we'd been, you know, I'd been thinking about this for a while, telling him something's got to change. So we got a divorce, and that was in 1980. And I was turning 40, and I knew I had to do something with my life. You know, just need to make a difference. And so I went back to school and got a PhD. And so this doctor of philosophy in nursing and a minored in rhetoric. So if I don't know what the truth is, man, I can make you believe I do. I'm a master. So anyway, after that, I noticed when he came to pick up, you know, our daughter, he was a lot nicer a lot of the time, and he wasn't always, you know, mean and angry and all that stuff he'd been. And then one day he brought along his 21-year-old girlfriend to pick her up, and I'm like, I wonder if I could get him back. And of course I could. And then could wish I hadn't. We were married again, and for so, you know, then when you throw in getting married and getting divorced to the same man, that's another, you know, part of that pattern. Back in therapy. And while we were getting that second divorce, I was, you know, had gone to therapy and was trying to work on my anger issues. And one day, we had a women's group, and one of the women walked in, and she said, you know, my name's so-and-so. I've been in Sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years. And I thought, well, that must not work very good either if you have to still go to therapy. But it set a seed. See, I knew there was Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned about it in nursing school. As a nurse, I've been kicked across the room and nearly knifed by folks that's in there having DTs. And I could always tell them what I learned in nursing school. When you hit your bottom, you go to AA. I had no idea what that meant. But I knew the words, and so I would tell folks. And so right after the divorce, I decided, well, let me try Al-Anon, see if I will can get a little better. And I went there once, and I knew that wasn't where I belonged. So I said, well, okay, I'll go to AA. And, you know, the first time I went, how you think that nobody knows that you're new. Nobody knows that you don't know a damn thing. You know, of course, you know, those of us that have been around knew. They knew. And I went in and, you know, just listened. And that being the Bible Belt, there's an awful lot of my God, you know, my God, and God does this, and God does that, and look at all. And so I decided I wasn't going to be an alcoholic because I don't believe in God. And so I only went to 4 meetings. And then 6 months later, after, you know, the time of really finding out that I was having alcohol problems. One morning, when I got up and my daughter got up, she said to me, "You know, Mom, sometimes when you drink, you get mean, just like Dad." And that was what it took for me to realize that alcohol did a lot more to me than I thought it did. Didn't just make me cute and precious and smarter. It could also turn me into my mother or my ex-husband. You know, that meanness that's down within can be released when you get enough spirits in there. So I started back to AA. And the next day, I was going to start. That was on a Sunday. Monday, I went to work, and I was the chairman of our, nurse peer review committee, and the nurse had been sent home on the weekend drunk, and I had to be the one that confronted her as in that position. And I was sitting there looking at her, and I thought, you know, that could be me very easily on the other side of the desk. And so, you know, I'd gotten to that place where I really had no control over how much I was going to drink once I started, and I drank every day. So, you know, but it was only sometimes I got real mean. But, see, I know enough of logic to say, you know, it can't be if A is alcoholic and B is non-alcoholic, you've got means in between. And if you've done it once, you move a lot closer to alcoholic. And I could not tolerate the thought of being that. So I decided right then I will not drink again. And then when the newcomers meeting, I didn't want to go to the advanced course. See, I went to the newcomers meeting, and they started that guide, and I said, I'm Carolyn, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm not going to believe in God, and I'm not doing your damn steps. And y'all said, keep coming back. Imagine that. Keep coming back. And you let me go through, 4 or 5 months of saying all that stuff. And I didn't do anything. They said, get a sponsor. Well, there weren't any women in there smart enough to sponsor me. Just, that rebelliousness and specialness has been, bubbling through my life. So I called one woman. I just picked a number out of the basket where I've been putting all those phone numbers, picked one out and called her. And she answered, and, she said to me, when I told her how bad the problem was, that my reputation might be affected, could you accept that? And I said, no, I don't like it. She said, I didn't say like it. Could you accept it? And I said, I guess I could in time. She said, then quit worrying. What? How do you do that? She said, what I have to do is get on my knees and pray. Well, if God's so big, how come he needs me on my knees? You get on your knees so you know who's praying to who. See, and this ego deflation in depth that it talked, in the big book, and there is a solution. It says that, almost none of us liked the self-examination, the leveling of our pride, the making of amends and those. See, I didn't think I had a big ego, of course. I mean, because other times I know, I ought not be wasting this air that I'm breathing. And I got this idea that I just won't ever be good enough. So after she told me that, I went in the bedroom and closed the door so the kids wouldn't see me. And got on my knees and said, whoever answers those people's prayers, help me. And I felt better in a little bit. I quit crying, and I got up, and I went on with the day. And that's pretty much been my experience through the rest of sobriety. I've done, I've done a lot of things in sobriety. I'm one of those people talk about how she knows the book, I knows the book. And I go by the book and by what I've been told in AA. And there's some wonderful things that have helped me get to the place, you know, where I am today. You know, like, you spot it, you got it. When they make me mad and then start looking at it. And my sponsor one time, when I was telling her how bad it was with this one woman at work, she said, did you ever not love them after you hear their fifth step? And it's like, oh, I'm going to have to go get to know that woman. Oh, no. You know, but this, what's my part? And who's praying to who has brought me through all this. And the same thing when I did my fourth step, I, of course, didn't do it like it says in the book. Because I don't like paper with lines, so I have to have, you know, do it my way. But anyway, I did it, and when I woke up that morning at 5 before I went to see that sponsor, I started reading it, and I could see all of a sudden, oh my goodness, what I have judged people for is things that I expect, which might not even be realistic. And I'm like, whoa! Done? Okay. So that thing is true. See, and when I first came here, I heard people talk about how, you know, when you think you know, you don't know. When you think you don't know, then you know. Well, that's kind of how I am about turning it over. What I know, what the other thing that I heard so much was, keep coming back. It gets better. And they told me that it is you. So now, see, I know that when I'm saying turning it over, that it is me. It's not all that stuff that I think it's about. Thanks for letting me be here.
So Carolyn was reminded me when she was speaking, after I had gotten into AA for a period of time, I spent about 3 or 4 years, and I started sponsoring people, which is a reluctant thing I didn't really want to do. I got a home group, which I really didn't want to do, but I got one anyway. Then my sponsor said I had to go to the home group meetings, so I started doing that. And decided after a period of time, well, maybe I can help out, but I wasn't going to do any service things in Alcoholics Anonymous, so, you know, I'm kind of special too. So after going to these for a little while, I decided I could do something. I'll be the treasurer or something. So I signed up to be the treasurer. And I had changed sponsors because one I had moved out of town, and he was telling me the same stuff, the new one. And we were working the book, the steps of the book, the same way the first one did. So I felt really lucky I had good sponsorship. But things were going along. I had some sponsees. Most of them weren't leaving as soon as I got off paper anymore. I had a few of them that were actually sticking around. And so I was patting myself on the back. I'm doing pretty good in this AA thing. If I just concentrate really well on working the steps AA, I will stay sober. And that was my thinking at that point in time. And I did a fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh step or something, and something came to light that in the process of doing all that, you know, I had taken back everything that I'd turned over when I did that first step. Second step and all that, and third step. I'd given that all away. I said, okay, I can't manage alcoholism, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's beyond my control. And I turned it all over, asked God in my life, which was tough for me at that time, and it wasn't so bad anymore. But I'd start thinking I can manage this again if I just do it my way and do it better. And for me, the idea of turning over was kind of like I did it once when I took the first step, or maybe even before I got here when I decided I couldn't do it on my own. And I had to do it again after I'd been around a while, because that ego started rebuilding, and I kept thinking I can do this, and it's me that's making things happen instead of the God of my understanding. So I had to turn it over again. And that's where, for me, this topic comes to mind. Our next speaker is Dan L. from Michigan, and he's been involved in some service, too. He tells me he was a DCM once, and I think he has 27 years, too.
Here's Dan.
Well, I don't know about all you folks, but my butt is sleeping. Woo! I'm Dan Lacey, and I'm an alcoholic. I got rooked into this by my sponsor. I didn't even know he had put my name in the hat, but until I got an email from New York, and so I'm happy to do it. And the subject, turn it over. You know, I've used that since day one. I've been sober since October 13th, 1989. And, you know, I say, you know, my very first meeting, you know, not to brag, but to show that it can be done. You know, relapse is not necessarily part of the program, although I understand it. Well, you know, I've got a lot of things in my life that I've had to turn over. You know, my ex-wife, I had to turn her over. You know, I had to turn over. One thing that I've given a lot of open talks in my day, but one thing I've never done is talked about my medical issues. And you talk about turning it over. In 2001, 12 years of sobriety, I had a liver transplant. And then in 2007, I had a kidney transplant. And then 6 months ago, I went through 7 weeks of radiation and chemo. I'm like the Timex watch. University of Michigan just going to put a zipper on me. But, you know, and it's only through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to get through those things. Not the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's just going to meetings. You know, but the program and the 12 steps, implementation and practice of the 12 steps, I've been able to turn it over and you know, let go and let God. You know, what choice do I have but to be enthusiastic? You know, there's a lot of things I can't change. My ex-wife. You know, there's a lot of things I can't change, and there's a lot of things that you know, I just have to accept and hope for the best. Hope for the best outcome. You know, I had a lot of Catholicism growing up, and I'm not a Catholic basher. I'm a proud Catholic, but I went to St. Mark's Middle School, St. Joseph's High School, and University of San Francisco, a Jesuit college. I mean, what are these folks in AA going to teach me about God? I mean, me and God were, you know, I'll tell you, I don't have that God of my ancestors anymore. I got a higher power. He kind of resides in the pit of my stomach. You know how you know when you're doing right, you know when you're doing wrong? You can just feel it. And, you know, just having that awareness, I'm able to turn things over. Things happen to me that there has to be a God. There's just no other explanation for it. One time, the company, I had a trip to North Carolina, and the company had a big company meeting, and the general manager said that we're either going to all have to take a 10% cut in pay, or we're going to have to lay off some people. You decide. And anyway, so I had this trip to North Carolina, and it's for potentially a big bit of business, and there's this guy there, Scott Foss. I remember his name, Scott Foss. He was the guru of compressed air, and that's what I had to meet up with. I had to meet up with Scott Foss, you know, and everybody told me about him. He either likes you or he hates you, and if he hates you, you ain't going to get a word in edgewise, and so I was all worried about it, and anyway, I always go to meetings. You know, I go out Sunday night and do business during the week. And so I went to Davidson, North Carolina. I went to a meeting. It was a treatment center Sunday night. And this guy got up and he gave a really good talk. And So at the beginning of the meeting, I said it. Dan from Detroit. No one would know where Shelby Township is. Detroit, Michigan. And so at the end of the talk, I said to the guy next to me, I said, man, it's a pretty good talk. I liked it, you know. And hey, what are you doing here from Detroit? I said, well, I got to go in to see somebody tomorrow over at such and such a plant. Anyways, he says, who are you going to see over there? I said, some jerk named Scott Foss. Scott Foss. I said, you got to be kidding me. He goes, done deal tomorrow. We've got the AA bond. Done deal tomorrow. You're just going to make it look good in the conference room. I got all those engineers, you know, make it look good, you know. Christ, I got back to the hotel and I just said to I called up and left the voicemail with my boss. Well, I'm so nervous about tomorrow. I would like to just get. But is that God? Is that God? Oh, and so I come back. I secured the order. I come back and there was no talk about a layoff or a cut in pay or anything. So that's God. In my life, strange things like that happen. Well, one thing that I recognize kind of letting go and turning it over, I did all my drinking out in California, and I used to hang out at this bar called the Lagoon Saloon, and they used to advertise a fight a night. And they had a mannequin down the end of the bar, and so when you walked in, you'd go, oh, who's that, you know, and you get down there. But so they had this canoe trip, and so I went on this canoe trip, and, you know, geez, we were all set. Friday night, we had just, Saturday morning, 7 o'clock, my head was just, bum, bum, bum. Why did I do this again? I can't believe it, you know, I should have known better, you know. Now I got to get in a canoe, and, So the guy that's getting everybody into the canoes and stuff, he says, this one turn down here, you got to be careful. Everybody usually loses it. It's kind of a cyclone turn. And me and my buddy, we were like, yeah, okay, right. You know, we got our cooler in the middle, and we're all set, you know, Varney sunglasses. So we go like this, and we're noticing people are losing it. They're starting to lose it. And all of a sudden, we get up close. Sure enough, boom, we tip over. And I went down underwater. I got hit in the head with canoe. All of a sudden, my shorts got stuck on this branch, and I really thought I was going to go see God. You know, I was like, I said, you know, I got to get some air here, you know? And so, boom, I broke off of the branch, and all of a sudden, I was in this, like, white water, and I'm trying to fight it. I was banging into things and crashing, and I couldn't believe it. And I was so tired and so exhausted, I just let go. I mean, I literally let go. And you know what? I just went around these rocks like a noodle. I was like, unbelievable. As soon as I stopped fighting, you know, the path was easy. So, you know, I don't know why I didn't turn it over when I was stuck on the branch, but so there was a clearing where everybody was getting ready, and everybody was getting their stuff back and yucking it up. And I'm in the water up to here. Has anybody got any shorts? But you know, I didn't recognize that till later on. I said, yeah, I let go, and I just went around those rocks, and I couldn't believe it. Suddenly, I wasn't crashing into stuff. So that's the way I do a lot of things in life. I turn it over. There's not much I can do, and I know that the big ranger has got my back. And, you know, what else do you need? Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.